From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Dirty surgical tools, flies in an operating room, veterans who never received essential follow-up care. Whistleblowers expose systemic failures at the Manchester, New Hampshire VA hospital.
These are our constituents and our citizens getting services there. So making sure that communication is clear, everything is transparent, there's nothing that's being put onto the back burner.
Also today, our Common Health team launches a special series on fighting Lyme disease, including lessons learned from France.
They actually are the first country ever to have a national plan to combat Lyme disease, yet they have fewer cases than we do.
Plus, a journey into the rainforest to learn the ancient art of chocolate making.
With the machete, he's cracked it open, and we see inside this amazing fruit. This does not look like chocolate.
No, looks like a lump of brain, but it is chocolate.
Looks like a lump of brain.
Yeah, a lump of brain.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Beacon Hill lawmakers have finally hammered out a compromise over contentious changes to the state's voter-approved recreational marijuana bill. Now, lawmakers had promised to deliver a bill to Governor Baker by June 30th. We're 17 days after that, but House and Senate lawmakers had been at odds over a number of the changes, including issues around local control and how much to tax recreational pot sales. Joining us now with details about the compromise is WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Hi there, Steve.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so let's start with the money. What compromise did lawmakers reach on the issue of taxing marijuana?
Well, on taxes, the overall max would be 20%. I'll give you a breakdown in a second, but just to remind you, the Senate wanted it to stay at 12%, which is what the voters had approved back in November. The House wanted to raise it up to 28%. They settled kind of in the middle at 20%. And how that breaks down, there's the 6.25% sales tax on everything that we buy. That it will be also on marijuana, 6.25% there. 10.75% excise tax that will go to the state, a marijuana excise tax. And then every community that has a dispensary or a pot shop would be able to charge up to 3% local tax. It's an option. The towns can choose not to go with that, but the conferees feel that every city and town that has a marijuana business will take that 3% because they can use the dough.
Yeah, exactly. So pretty much down the middle, as you said there, on the issue of how much to tax recreational pot sales. Now, you mentioned cities and towns that choose to have sales facilities in their localities. There was some struggle over how towns could opt out if they wanted to. What conclusion did we reach there?
Well, they did reach a compromise. It's a little complicated, but I'll try to explain it to you. If your city voted yes on question four, now my town voted yes on question four, if my town wanted to ban a marijuana shop, they would have to come back to the voters, come back to us again, and ask us, do you want to ban marijuana? You voted for question four, but now that it's going to be in your backyard, do you want to deny these businesses? You would be able to vote no, and it would have to go to the voters. Now, if your town or your city or town voted against question four, if they voted no, we didn't want to make marijuana legal at all back in November, then it would be just a simple vote by your city or town council or your board of selectmen. They'd be able to say, no, we don't want to have marijuana businesses of any sort here in our business, in our community.
Oh, interesting, Steve. So it seems to actually place some significant weight on the decision of those voters who bothered to go to the polls last November.
That's right. I mean, as I mentioned, the town I live in voted in favor of question four. However, at our town meeting, we voted against allowing businesses to come in. So there's still a little bit of a question of now, do we still have to go to a referendum, a town referendum, and ask us again that question, do you want to ban marijuana shop? And it's not just dispensaries. It could be, you might want to, there might be a business that just grows or processes or something and doesn't have people coming in as a retail thing. You know, a city or town can ban expand that sort of business as
right,
well.
Right, right. Well, so, I mean, this was a contentious process because a lot of people really took issue with the fact that lawmakers were considering making any changes to the law mm-hmm. that was stipulated in the text of question four. But given that, we have reached a compromise, as you've outlined here. So how fast do we expect the bills to move forward and possibly be made into law?
I think it's safe to say that this bill will be on the governor's desk by the end of the week. Right now, they're still basically, as they say, crossing the T's and dotting the I's, to go with a cliche that is used an awful lot up here. They're going over that. They will presumably submit it to the House clerk's office by the end of the day today. And the House will probably take it up on Wednesday. The Senate will probably take it up on Thursday. This is an up or down vote. There's no amendments. There's no changes. It's do you like this or do you not? Historically, the legislature always accepts a conference committee report. I've never seen them reject one. So, like I say, it'll probably be on the governor's desk by the end of the week.
That's WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown bringing us up to speed on the compromise reached on Beacon Hill over changes to the state's voter-approved recreational marijuana bill. Steve, thank you so much, and I want to note that we managed to get through that entire conversation without using any pot-related puns, which I think is a first.
You know, I was going to talk about smoke coming from the conference committee room indicating a decision, kind of like the Pope, but I didn't go that way, but now I did. Okay.
Better late than never. Thanks again, Steve.
Have a great one.
All right, one more politics note here. I just want to remind all of you about Radio Boston's special conversations this week we have scheduled with the major candidates for mayor of Boston, incumbent Mayor Marty Walsh and his challenger, City Councilor Tito Jackson. On Wednesday at 3, we'll be having this special live forum with Tito Jackson. And then on Thursday at 3, same thing with Mayor Walsh. Radio Boston and WBUR, along with the Boston Globe and the McCormick School at UMass Boston, are co-sponsoring these forums. We've got tickets you can attend, and we really encourage you to do so. Register at WBUR.org/events, and you can, of course, listen live right here at 90.9 WBUR. Well, how is it possible, after years of scrutiny and criticism for poor service and even at times negligence of the patients in its care, how is it possible that the Veterans Administration awarded a 4-star rating to its hospital in Manchester, New Hampshire, when that hospital routinely had huge problems like flies in an operating room, improperly sterilized surgical equipment, and poor treatment of some vets? Treatment so poor it could have resulted in paralysis. Well, those are just some of the urgent questions raised by the stunning Boston Globe Spotlight Team investigation into the Manchester VA hospital. And joining us now with more is Jonathan Saltzman. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe and a member of the Spotlight Team. Jonathan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Stuart Levinson. He's a rheumatologist and the chief of medicine at the Manchester VA. He's one of the 11 whistleblowers in this case. Dr. Levinson, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me as well.
Doctor, I'm going to come back to you in a minute, but I just want to sort of have Jonathan lay the groundwork here in terms of what the Spotlight Team published over the weekend about the Manchester VA hospital. First of all, Jonathan, how did this story come to light for you guys?
What happened was several of these whistleblowers contacted the editor of the Spotlight Team. Frankly, it was close to a year ago. And we'd just done an investigative story on the practices of double book surgeries at some teaching hospitals. And as I recall, some of these whistleblowers said, you should check out the situation in Manchester for different kind of different problems.
I see. So they were so alarmed that that they decided they wanted additional scrutiny being placed on the Manchester VA by the media. So tell us, Jonathan, about some of the things that that the whistleblowers talked to you about. They also talked to federal authorities as well. I mean, I named a couple of them: surgical equipment that wasn't properly sterilized, flies in an operating room. I mean, it's astounding.
Yeah, and what's interesting is in some cases, some of those were in the original information that the whistleblowers shared with us. I think the key to this story is that there was one physician who was actually a relative newcomer to Manchester, a doctor named Ed Coyce, who specialized in pain treatment and spine treatment. And a few years ago, after he arrived there, he started noticing that a lot of the veterans had severe spinal injuries. And he initially thought, my God, they must have been in some terrible combat. And what he ended up determining, he says, is that a lot of them suffered from a largely treatable condition called cervical myelopathy. And they'd deteriorated because they had not really been monitored and no one had really intervened. And as a result of that, he kind of started making basically a stink about it.
Right.
And then a number of other doctors started coming forward, and lots of other things came up, from the flies to the lack of sterile equipment to really a whole host of other problems.
Well, I mean, in the Globe Spotlight story, there's a sentence from an email exchange between an outside doctor and a physician at the VA saying that the condition that you were talking about, Jonathan, usually is not seen in developed countries because it is so treatable. I mean, it's really shocking. Dr. Stuart Levinson, thank you for being so patient with us.
Not at all.
You are retiring as chief of medicine at the Manchester VA. Is that right?
Yes, in approximately 2 weeks.
How many years were you there?
18 years.
Can you tell me about the patterns that you witnessed?
Well, in this specific case with the myelopathies, what had happened was Dr. Coyce came to me with a letter that he had from an orthopedic neurologic surgeon at New England Baptist who said he hadn't seen conditions like this since doing pro bono work in rural Nigeria. I sent that letter up through the chain of command and nothing was accomplished. I then contacted the Spotlight team, their editor, and said, I have such a letter from the neurologic surgeon. And I got a very speedy reply saying, do you actually possess this letter? And I forwarded it. And then we started talking, and more issues started coming up.
Well, so, I mean, you were there for 18 years, though. I mean, were there things that you witnessed in terms of how the hospital was run that had caused you some concern prior to that?
There were always some challenges at any hospital, maybe at a VA medical center more than some other hospitals. But over the last few years, they had really boiled to a head. Instead of addressing these problems, leadership was sloughing them off. Before the current administration, if there was a patient who needed urgent surgery for a myelopathy, it would be approved to be obtained in the private sector. Then we had this meeting with the current administration. We talked about some patients that needed surgery, and the response was to look at the so-called hierarchy of care memo, which said you had to send these patients to sister VAs. We sent patients to Boston, to Connecticut. We got such ridiculous consultative reports. If they would accept the patient to get physical therapy, many of the times we'd put in a consult and the consult would be discontinued or forwarded to physical therapy, that these issues were just not being addressed. As I became aware of these issues, I would bring them to my leadership. And one by one, they just kept building up along with the frustration level.
Now, Jonathan Salzman, Globe Spotlight reporter, the Globe interviewed hospital director Daniel Ocker and her chief of staff, Dr. James Schlosser. I understand that there's been some update in terms of the position held by those two.
Yeah, they have yesterday. So the story ran in yesterday's paper. And in the late afternoon yesterday, the spokesperson for secretary of the VA, Shulkin, said that those two officials were being removed pending the outcome of a top-to-bottom review by Shulkin. So they moved very swiftly after the story ran. just a matter of hours.
Right. Now, Dr. Levinson, let me ask you. The Globe, in its story, profiled several patients. One of them is Robert McWinney, right? He's a Korean War veteran, lives in New Hampshire, and he's relied mainly on a wheelchair to get around for some time. Now, in the Globe story, they found that over some 21 years, almost, Mr. McWinney went to the Manchester VA dozens of times for treatment. He had had previously, before that, he had treatment for a tumor on his spine and should have been receiving regular checkups for that issue in and of itself. But over the course of two decades, he never received adequate follow-up for that ailment. Now, how is that possible?
That is tragic. What happened was the tumor was never completely removed. It was slow growing and, I believe, somewhat benign. So it just needed follow-up, and when it grew to a certain size, would have to be removed again. But he was seen at the West Roxbury or Jamaica Plain Boston VA and treated, released without specific follow-up. The remainder of his follow-up was in primary care. In primary care, it became a documentation of his decline over the years. First of all, his surgery was botched from the get-go. I believe if this is the patient we're talking about, they accidentally cut his phrenic nerve during the surgery, so he was unable to breathe from his right lung. It was just a horrible misadventure from the get-go, with errors being compounded by poor follow-up.
What's interesting about that, if I can jump in.
Yeah, please.
What's interesting about that particular case is, so he has an attorney, Mr. McWinney does, and his attorney is not claiming that they're not suing based on the fact that this guy's phrenic nerve was cut. Nor are they even suing on the fact that this tumor, which is called a schwannoma, was not removed entirely from his spinal canal, because it is that can happen. It's the fact that he noted, this was the Boston VA neurosurgeon, that it had not been removed, and then through the many, many years after, two decades after, it wasn't monitored. And yet, according to the attorney, the standard of care for that is for that kind of tumor to be monitored just for this very reason, to make sure that it does not return.
So Jonathan and Dr. Levinson, this brings me back to the question that I asked at the very top of our conversation here. How is this allowed to happen? And how is this allowed to happen? And the VA giving the Manchester Hospital a 4-star rating, the highest is 5 stars, right? I mean, there seems to be ample evidence here of some sort of systemic failure at this hospital.
May I answer that?
Yes,
the
please.
Fact is, the ratings and the criteria that are being rated aren't indicative of quality. They're things that have to do with patient satisfaction, with bed days of care. And unfortunately, in this type of rating system, if you're looking at specific items, anything you're not specifically looking at gets ignored.
Oh, interesting.
So if it were a system like you get a star for a lack of patient complaints or a lack of infections on the geriatric unit, you could have those criteria being met because you're watching those very carefully because you know you're going to be judged on that, but everything else could be falling well short of acceptance.
And standards. In many cases here, it seems as if veterans didn't even think to complain about the substandard treatment they were getting.
Well, that's a very interesting factor because veterans as a group don't like to complain. They consider the VA to be part of the government that took care of them, that they served. They served the United States. In many ways, the VA is the provider of last resort for some of these patients, so they really don't want to rock the boat. They're afraid it'll come back to haunt them. But many of them, they just don't want to complain. They feel that they're getting older, their body's deteriorating. How could it be the hospital's fault? I have one patient who also, I believe, had severely botched surgery, and he wanted no part of coming forward. He said, I'm been wounded many times in Vietnam. I'm getting older. I can't hold the government responsible for my body falling apart.
Now, Jonathan, in your conversations with hospital administrators, what reasons did they give you for these failures possibly happening? I know that the hospital was in the red, right, by some $6 million?
Yeah, but the hospital really, only until the end of last week, did they even confirm that. They never cited financial concerns in terms of explaining what the situation was. I mean, candidly, we interviewed Ms. Ocker, who's the director of the hospital, and Dr. Schlosser, the chief of staff. They really didn't deny any of the things that we had been told. We brought up the fact that instruments had been had not been sterilized. We had internal documents showing that unsterilized instruments were used on one of three vets, but the hospital did not know who. We told them we had a picture of an OR that had been abandoned to flies and had a fly zapper standing as sentry in the OR. They didn't really deny any of it. I think the essence of what they said was that, patient care is not suffering, and that that they are doing the best that they can, and that they believe that it is a safe hospital. But that was pretty much the extent of their defense.
Interesting. Now, the federal VA in Washington has said that they are investigating as thoroughly as they possibly can the issues raised in your reporting and by whistleblowers, including you, Dr. Levinson. So we'll see where that goes. But Doctor, I keep thinking that you've spent 18 years there. I've just got a couple last questions for you.
Sure.
I mean, did you ever see anything in that time in previous years that rose to the level where you felt that something was amiss? Because as you said,
this didn't
happen overnight, right?
Actually, let me answer that. There were always problems, but nothing like this. And never was the administration so tone deaf to these complaints. At one point, for many years while I was at the VA, the chief administrator, the director, was a physician who was formerly the chief of staff, formerly a staff physician. I could go into his office, explain a complex problem, and he might not be able to solve it on the spot, but at least he would make an honest attempt. I truly believe the current administration had very little interest in solving problems other than their bottom line.
Well, what do you hope comes out of the investigation that the VA is
doing? Well, first, I
hope
it's an honest investigation. I learned this morning the investigation is being conducted by the OMI, the Office of Medical Inspector, and we've already been through one investigation by the OMI, and it was pretty much biased and came to conclusions that were self-protecting. Because you've got to remember, both the OIG, the Office of Inspector General, and the OMI work within the VA. They were given the mandate for the last investigation by the Office of Special Counsel, and even the Office of Special Counsel felt that the investigation was a whitewash. So I'm hopeful that Dr. Shulkin is going to be an honest broker of investigation, but that remains to be seen.
And finally, what does it mean to you that 2 weeks away from retirement, this is where you find yourself, being one of 11 whistleblowers on a case as large as this?
It's very disturbing. Not only 2 weeks from retirement, any point in my career, it would have been disturbing. I take pride in where I work. I love taking care of veterans. They've been the best patient population you can ever hope for. They're responsive to wanting care. They meet you more than halfway. They're as grateful as you can ever expect of any patient population, and they're certainly a very deserving group.
Well, Dr. Stuart Levinson is the chief of medicine at the Manchester VA. He's one of 11 whistleblowers in this case. Dr. Levinson, thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you, Jonathan, for your work.
Yeah. And Jonathan Saltzman, thank you as well. I'll echo that. Spotlight team reporter for the Boston Globe. We'll have a link to their reporting at our website, radioboston.org. Jonathan, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, I'm about to say two words that I know are pretty triggery to some of you. Ann Coulter. And now I'm going to say two other words that are also pretty triggery. Airline travel. Or as the online magazine Fusion put it, Ann Coulter's meltdown over a $30 Delta upgrade is making me cheer for an airline and I hate it. Hats off to you, Fusion, because that's exactly how I feel. It's pretty much the best way to describe the considerable feeling engendered by Coulter's ongoing Twitter attack against Delta, all because the airline moved her from an extra legroom aisle seat that she had paid for to a window seat, but get this, in the very same row. Now, this is Ann Coulter, so I'm going to go public radio genteel here and describe her as a right-wing polemicist. Her tweets really don't deserve repetition. Suffice it to say, she's compared Delta employees to Stasi policeman and the woman who ended up in her seat to a dachshund. But then again, Coulter also has her supporters. But even amongst her critics, some grudgingly agree maybe Delta shouldn't have made the last second change. So for more on this and what it means for you, the regular flyer, we're joined by Brett Snyder. He runs the blog crankyflyer.com. He also worked in the airline industry for United and America West Airlines, and he joins us now from Long Beach, California. Brett, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So your blog is crankyflyer.com, but I think Ann Coulter is probably the crankiest flyer of the week. I mean, what do you make of the fact that she decided to take to Twitter to attack Delta for making this change?
Well, I mean, she's not the only one, right? People take to Twitter to attack airlines yeah. all the time for doing something they don't like. It's just she's very visible and is going to get a lot more attention for it.
Yeah, I mean, but we're living in a day where it seems as if airlines are getting a lot of deserved scrutiny for making changes to folks' travel plans. Now, this isn't a United Airlines-level event where someone got violently dragged off the airplane. But do you have any sympathy for her at all? Because, you know, she researched a seat, decided the one she wanted, paid for it, and then Delta made the last-second change after she was on board.
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, if you're a traveler, any traveler, you know, forget about Ann Coulter because that's obviously a polarizing figure, but if you're a traveler and you wanted an aisle seat and you paid for that seat and they move you to a window, you probably wouldn't be happy about that, right? Is it the end of the world? Are you going to try and, you know, bring down an airline and take this on and on for days and days? Probably not, but yeah, it's still not something you'd like to happen.
Yeah, definitely. Now Delta has refunded Coulter the $30 value for her inconvenience, the inconvenience it caused her, I should say. A Delta representative tweeted, quote, "I understand how this must be extremely frustrating, Anne, and I'd like to extend my sincere apology." Also, they went on to criticize her for attacking Delta employees on her Twitter feed. But let me ask you, I mean, so for those of us who don't necessarily want to go out and call airline employees horrible names, I mean, what is the best way to communicate with a company, with an airline, when they do make changes like this?
Well, if something happens that you had actually paid for a specific service and you didn't get that service, so, you know, let's say she had paid for this extra legroom seat and they had moved her to a different seat that had no extra legroom on it, they're going to refund that to you. You know, it would be nice if you could just raise your hand and say, okay, give me the money, and it would magically appear, but usually what you have to do is contact the airline and kind of work through the channels that they provide after travel. And so, you know, go to the airline website, go to the customer relations pages. Sometimes there's a refunds page you can go to and submit a request for it. But, you know, in a case like that, you're not going to see someone denying your refund. If you do, you can always try and escalate to make sure someone understands what's happening. But in a case like this, she still got the extra legroom seat. It wasn't the same seat that she wanted. My guess is Delta just said it's not worth $30. Let's just give it back and move on.
Right.
But in general, yeah, if you pay for something you don't get, then they'll refund that for you.
There's the presumption here again, putting Ann Coulter aside for a moment though, that like when you book your ticket or even days later, whatever, before you check in and you pay the extra money and you're online and you look at the map of the seats and you say, no, I want that particular extra legroom seat in the aisle, row 15. I mean, that's the one you want. There's a presumption that is the one you should get. So does making these changes, just choosing seats in advance, matter, or do airlines frequently switch things up the way they did with Coulter?
Well, it does matter. I mean, if you see a seat that you like and you want to reserve it, then great, do that. And, you know, most of the time you will get that seat. But on occasion, they do have to make changes. Sometimes there's an aircraft change, and so they have to move seats because it's a different configuration. Other times, you know, sometimes a seat can break, and so they have to move people around. Or there are a variety of operational reasons that they might have to do that. In this case, what it sounds like, and we don't have full details, but what it sounds like in this case is that they were trying to accommodate several different people who wanted to make changes and in the end accidentally, or according to them, accidentally inadvertently moved her to the window instead of the aisle. So, you know, sometimes things like that can happen, but it's not something that you should just expect will happen every time that you're going to get moved out of your seat. It's still worth trying to reserve it in advance.
Yeah. Now, how do you think Delta's handling this? Because, I mean, my personal opinion about Ann Coulter doesn't really matter here. She actually has, you know, thousands and thousands of loyal followers and supporters. Are they taking a chance by criticizing her for her tone on Twitter? I mean,
well,
is Delta taking a chance?
Her. Yeah. People love her or hate her. There's no real in-between here. So you're going to anger people regardless of which way you respond in a case like this, I think. You know, they had to make a decision on how to approach it, and I think they've tried to kind of toe the line by saying, you know, we're sorry and here's your money back, but also, hey, don't, you know, wagging the finger at them. Don't yell at our employees and say bad things about them and our customers and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, maybe they're hoping there's a little bit in there for everyone to grasp onto and say good job.
Yeah, well, I'll be honest. It's a message probably lost on Ann Coulter, to be perfectly honest. But Brett Snyder, he runs the blog crankyflyer.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brett.
No, you're welcome.
All right, we'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, it's Monday, and it's time for our regular Common Health segment with Common Health host WBR's Carrie Goldberg. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so you're in today to talk about a series that Common Health is launching about Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses, right?
That's right. And we're calling the series Losing to Lyme because the big picture statistics are really troubling. Lyme disease reports have more than doubled since 2005. And by the way, we know that those reports are small by a factor of probably about 10. Like the 5,000 plus cases of Lyme that are reported in Massachusetts every year are probably actually more like 50,000.
Wow.
You know, so the fact is that this summer, as everyone in Massachusetts and beyond is having a lovely time in the beautiful outdoors, we're basically playing tick roulette. And that's especially true this summer when it's predicted that ticks will be particularly abundant. And by the way, Meghna, the ticks seem to even be getting more urban. Like there have been a couple of reports of Lyme disease caught in the Arnold Arboretum lately.
Oh, wow. Okay, so me duct taping my pants to my socks isn't necessarily a terrible idea. Okay.
You are not a nerd for doing that.
Yeah. No. So we are not alone in our tick obsession, Carrie, because today with us, we've also got alongside of you, Dr. David Scales. He's a physician at Cambridge Health Alliance. Hi there, Dr. Scales.
Hi, Meghna.
50,000 cases, huge number.
Yes, huge. And that's because what happens is there's underreporting of Lyme disease. So doctors don't necessarily report Lyme disease, and not everyone needs to have the test to prove that they have Lyme disease. If you have the big bullseye rash, that's enough to say that you have Lyme. So a lot of those cases don't get reported.
Okay, so you are the lead reporter on this Common Health series. So tell us more about it.
Yeah, so it's a series about trying to understand why we don't seem to be making progress on Lyme disease. What's the big problem here? Like, we've been able to put a man on the moon. Why can't we get a handle on this disease? It's the kind of thing where we're really realizing that we're doing a lot about education. You, just like you said, we know that we need to duct tape our pants. We know that we need to do tick checks, but education just doesn't seem to be enough. What's the next step?
And a big piece of it is that there's just not a lot of funding, both for research and for, you know, trying to control the ticks in the environment.
And vaccines.
So we also get
why don't we have one?
Right. Like for the eternal question of why can my dog get a vaccine and I can't, Dr. David Scales will be looking at that as well.
Yeah, we'll have a piece on that.
Okay. And I understand you're also looking at new approaches to treating Lyme?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So I was very hopeful when I went to a place in Boston called the Dean Center at Spalding Rehab in Charlestown. This is a place that's been open for 2 years, but they have a different focus on treating people with the symptoms of chronic Lyme disease. And so this is a focus, instead of answering the really controversial question about long-term antibiotics, they try to take an agnostic position on the antibiotics question, and they focus a lot more on rehabilitative therapy, on improving functionality for people that really feel disabled and debilitated because of their symptoms that they've been having.
And for the pièce de résistance of the series, we're also sending Dr. Scales to France with a Pulitzer grant that he won to look at how France is handling Lyme, which is, I would say, sort of more in a more organized way and more active way than we do.
Okay, organized and active, but are they doing a better job? Is their incidence of Lyme lower than ours?
So, yes, it is lower. And so what's interesting is they actually are the first country ever to have a national plan to combat Lyme disease, yet they have fewer cases than we do. So I'm going to go find out to see if they're a lot more organized, or what are they doing differently?
Okay, well, I'm anxious to hear what you find out on that trip. Now, Dr. Scales, I have to add something here, because you're not just a medical doctor. You're also a PhD. You've got a PhD in sociology. So how does that all work in? I mean, is there a sociological aspect to some of the takeaways from this series?
Yeah, there's a lot of sociological aspects to this, because so much of this has to do with human behavior and how we interact with our environment. So when it comes down to it, a lot of people say that in order to combat Lyme disease, it takes a village. So this gets into the sociology. We can do as much as we want as an individual, but unless we come together and start attacking this problem as a neighborhood, as a community, as a town, as a state.
As a country,
right. Ticks don't respect property boundaries. They don't respect town boundaries. So this is the kind of thing, if we don't work together as a group, we're not really going to be able to make progress against ticks.
What else surprised you?
So I was really surprised at how much something like permethrin works. Permethrin is a tick-killing chemical. You know, I was like you, Meghna. I might duct tape my pants or something like that before I went out, and I would do tick checks afterwards. But I was really surprised when I met with a lot of tick scientists, like Dick Johnson, the tick project coordinator on Martha's Vineyard. He has a fantastic way of protecting himself against ticks. He really focuses on spraying his clothes with permethrin, his shoes. This is a guy that handles thousands of ticks a year, and he says he's been bitten once that he knows of. So I was surprised by the permethrin. It works. I was also really surprised. When I went to medical school, I was taught that your risk of getting Lyme disease is really highest in the summer and not really there in the winter. And it was really sobering to find out that winter is actually still risky.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that climate change seems to be one of the factors. If the summers are longer, ticks have longer to feed, makes it easier for them to survive the winter, and the winters are shorter. So it makes it so that our risk for getting Lyme disease could happen at any time of year.
And I'd really like you to talk about the testing, Dr. David Scales, because that's really, I think that's key in the controversy to a large extent.
That's right. Good question. So one of the things that's constantly come up is people come up to me saying, oh, but isn't the testing horrible? And the short answer, the testing is not great. But
you're talking about the diagnostic testing for Lyme disease.
Correct,
right?
Yes. Yeah. The diagnostic testing for Lyme disease, the testing's not great. But there's a lot of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, in the sense that the tests themselves aren't that great, but they're not necessarily any worse than a lot of other tests we use in medicine. So, and it's also a question of making sure we use them at the right time. So, for example, a test you might use for your child, a rapid strep test to check to see if they have strep throat, that's a very good test. But if you use that test at the wrong time, it's horrible. And so a lot of what I'm seeing is people using Lyme disease tests at the wrong time that give a lot of confusing information.
Hmm. So lots of false positive, lots of false negatives.
Exactly.
It's just messy.
Can we just go back to the permethrin
for a
second? Because, of course, as a mom, the first question I have is, do I want to be spraying that stuff on my kids?
It's a good question. So I wouldn't spray it directly on children. The issue is to spray it directly on your clothes, let your clothes dry, and then I would use it after that. So it should be on your clothes. You can buy clothes that already are embedded with permethrin. It's from what we know right now, it is safe. It is the same stuff that we use in treatments for lice. So if your children have ever had lice, that's what's in the shampoo. It's the same treatment we use in our skin for scabies. Not that a lot of people have scabies. But it's the kind of thing that it's not absorbed through the skin. It's a chemical that up till right now seems to be very safe, though very toxic to ticks.
Okay. Thank you for that note. Now, I come away from this conversation wondering one thing. Are we doing anything right about combating Lyme disease?
Yes, we're doing a lot right. We have a lot of antibiotics that work really well. If we catch it early, we can really combat this disease very well. And frankly, there's a lot of really great research going on to really understand the aspects that we don't understand, the chronic Lyme symptoms, the relationship with people that get the proper treatment but still have symptoms. So these kinds of things, I think we're doing right. It's just not as fast as we would like it to happen.
And the education does help too, right?
Like that's right.
Barnstable County is doing a great job, other places.
Yes. Yeah. Education is a fantastic thing that we are really doing well, and we could always be doing better, but the more you know, the better prepared you'll be.
So everybody, listen to this series on read this series on Common Health. Get yourself educated about Lyme. Dr. David Scales, he's a physician at Cambridge Health Alliance and the lead reporter on the WBUR Common Health series, Losing to Lyme. Thank you so much, Dr. Scales.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Jeff, follow me. Let's go get some cacao.
Recently, wildlife biologist and host of ABC's Ocean Treks, Jeff Corwin, went to a remote Mayan village in San Pedro, Colombia, to learn an ancient secret. And he sent us this audio postcard.
We're here in a traditional Mayan cacao plantation. I'm with Feliciano Pup. And your family has been producing chocolate for how many generations?
I am the third generation.
And it goes back for how many years?
Thousands of years, man.
The people that live in these rainforest-topped hills have been making chocolate and growing the cacao exactly the way we're about to do now.
Yeah.
Can we see inside the pot?
Sure.
Luciano's got his machete. And he's carefully sliced away the pod from the tree. And with the machete, he's cracked it open. And we see inside this amazing fruit. Feliciano, this does not look like chocolate.
No, looks like a lump of brain, but it is chocolate.
Looks like a lump of brain.
Yeah, a lump of brain.
And when you taste it...
It tastes good stuff.
How would you describe that flavor?
Fruity.
It has a taste of melon, pineapple, banana, a sweet, sour, sticky fruit.
Mm-hmm. Slimy.
It's delicious.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
In a hot day like this, it's refreshing.
Absolutely. You see all these beans right here? This will make the chocolate. But it still has to go through some process yet. We got to take these beans, ferment it, sun-dry it, and then we roast it, crush it to make hot chocolate drink and even chocolate bars.
I've made my way to the cooking area of the Pup family home. I look above, I see a thatched roof. It's stained from generations of smoke. I look out and I see other thatched roofs. There are chickens and roosters, turkeys gobbling about. And above us, there are rolling clouds coming in, and it sounds like a thunderstorm is soon to pass. Victoria is taking a handful of the nibs onto the stone. She's grinding it back and forth. And very quickly, we see this amazing reaction, those powdery dry nibs, that smoky aroma being released, is being converted into a paste as the oils and fats are released, causing this mixture to be bound together.
So now, Jeff, we're going to dilute the paste with hot water to make our cacao drink.
Hot water's poured in.
So now, Jeff, the drink is ready. Cacao drink.
Victoria's filled up a little calabash gourd, a squash gourd, and pours it into my little gourd cup. The smell is intense, has a spiciness to it, a richness to it. And when you taste it, pure chocolate sings through. It's almost like drinking a liquefied time machine that takes us back to the age of the ancient Mayas, the people that lived in this rainforest landscape thousands of years ago. This is what it tasted like when they drank it. And this...
Pure.
That's a great way to describe it. Pure. And we're reminded of the great importance of chocolate back then and as it is today, celebrated around the world. Victoria, thank you so much for this experience.
You're welcome.
Cheers to you.
Hey, cacao.
That's wildlife biologist Jeff Corwin. He was in San Pedro, Colombia, Belize. That piece was produced with help from Michael Velasco. And Jeff is actually here with us in the studio. It's great to see you again, Jeff.
Delighted to be here.
So learning how to make Mayan chocolate in Belize. And I'm sorry, I misidentified where you were when we first introduced that lovely audio postcard. So I just want to apologize to the residents of San Pedro, Colombia, Belize. But tell us about this experience.
Well, it was delightful to be able to explore this rainforest. It's actually a rainforest where I did my graduate work. But not on chocolate. I did that on snakes and bats. But I always had a fascination with how the Mayan community would harvest and grow chocolate. So I traveled to this village and connected with this incredible family that have been making chocolate for generations, as they have done for over 2,500 years.
Wow. Now, our staff here knows that I regularly consume hot chocolates, but the sort of horrible powdered industrial variety that we can get in stores here. You've brought in some of what you made.
I just made this at home today.
Okay.
I made this fresh.
Okay. But using those techniques.
I used basically pure chocolate grown in the jungle. So what we've done first is you can see the chocolate beans. You can smell the ones that have been fermented, and they have a slightly sour taste. But if you smell the ones that have been toasted, you can actually smell the chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I have a metate, and this is the grinding stone.
Yeah.
Now, what you have to remember is chocolate was so important to the ancient Mayan community. It was actually a form of currency. The scientific name of chocolate is Tia Broma Cacao, which means the drink of the gods.
Uh-huh.
And that's what it was. It was the original energy drink because it had caffeine. And legend has it that folks that were unfortunately had the poor disposition of being sacrificed, as many were, their last rite was a nice drink of chocolate they moved on.
Now, this metate, did I say that right?
Yes,
that
the metate.
It looks like a mortar
and pestle. It's a mortar and pestle.
But the one you have here, it looks well used.
It is. It's about 1,000 years old.
Okay.
And so if you peel back the outer shell of the toasted chocolate, you see this curious seed inside.
Yeah.
That's the nib. Now, it starts out dry, and when I start moving it around very quickly, you can see it starts to liquefy.
Right.
It's very heavy.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I got it.
And if you take your finger, smear that, smell it, and taste it.
Oh, okay. And these were like the oils and the fats being released, as
yes,
you were talking about.
The fats, that is pure 100% dark chocolate. Now,
okay,
what you have to remember
is
that the ancient Mayans who treasured this drink, they did not have sugar because sugar didn't come until European explorers came. They did not have milk. They didn't have any dairy products. So it would have been served with roasted corn, maize, which... corn originated in the jungles of Central America. Chilies, honey, fermented agave. These were the ingredients. And this is what's in this. This is pure chocolate with water, chilies, and honey. Actually, honey from my bees.
Okay. I'm going to give it a try here. I cannot wait.
It's different, isn't it?
That is amazing. I drink a lot of hot chocolate, people. This is unlike anything I've had
so
before.
So you get that sort of hit of pepper in the back of your throat. You get the bitterness of the chocolate. And it was fortified with the corn, the maize. So essentially, it is an energy drink. It has caffeine in it. It has all the properties to lift up your energy when you're working in that traditional Mayan farm called the milpa.
So let me ask you, Jeff, the history of chocolate as you're describing it, its importance to Mayan culture, I mean, how important is the role of chocolate production of cacao in, for example, rainforest conservation now?
Well, it's interesting because we know that we lose rainforest at a disastrous rate. Every hour... we destroy 3,000 acres of rainforest. That's the size of Connecticut and trees, animals, and plants scraped off the earth every year. So chocolate evolved in a rainforest. This is the ecosystem where this incredible product began. So to grow chocolate in a healthy, successful, sustainable manner, you need a healthy rainforest. And in San Pedro, Colombia, Belize, the actual plantation of this chocolate farm, this cacao plantation, grows in a tropical rainforest.
Wow. Well, Jeff Corwin, he's a wildlife biologist, conservationist, host of the ABC series Ocean Treks with Jeff Corwin, and today he brought to us the taste of Mayan history and culture.
Time travel back
exactly.
to the ancient Mayans, but without the sacrifice.
No human sacrifices here. But Jeff, it is always so great to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it.
Well, that's it for today, everyone. I'm going to drink my Mayan hot chocolate here. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.